Well, I'm going to introduce to you a formula, but it's not a math formula. It's a formula for life. And it goes like this. Life plus the holidays equals stress. Life plus the holidays equals stress. The holidays can be a time of stress for a variety of reasons. Some of you are living it right now. I mean, think of all the cooking and cleaning. How many dozens of cookies have you baked? How many loaves of banana bread have you packaged? How about the cleaning? Some of you men, you had to pull out the couch because your wife said, listen, we're having company come. You pull out the couch. You vacuum behind it. You're like, look at these treasures behind the couch. Some of you had to dust off your bookshelves. Stress of cooking and cleaning. The stress of home improvement projects. You know, the holidays are wonderful times for wives to get those home improvement projects done. They say things like, listen, your family's coming to town and you need to paint that room. Or, listen, your family's coming to town, so you need to hang up that picture or hang up that wreath. How much of that have you done? It's just stress. How about the stress of shopping? Any of you done that? You stand in long lines. You hustle and bustle through crowded stores. You make the race for those last top toys. I just Googled this. I was trying to find what are the top toys this year. It used to be Tickle Me Elmo, but now it's Big Hugs Elmo. This year, yeah, Big Hugs Elmo, Leap Pad Ultra, and Despicable Me 2 Minions. Yeah, those are the top toys, and people are waiting in long lines to get them, and it's stressful. How about the stress of managing your money, paying the bills, going on long trips, whining kids, extended family members, and the list could go on and on. Life plus holidays equals stress. I think many of you can identify with that. But let's be honest. The holidays aren't the only time that we feel stress, are they? I mean, there's the day in and day out stresses and strains of life. Sometimes life just gives us a pounding with both fists. Sometimes we get raked and harrowed with the pain of things that happen along the course of our life. And it just causes a lot of stress. Now, I've been talking about this word, but maybe we should really identify what stress is so that we're all on the same page. What is stress? Well, stress is the thing that keeps you awake at night. Stress is the thing that keeps you from focusing at work. Stress is what you feel because of a nagging worry or a gnawing concern that just won't go away. Stress is what's ruined your appetite. Stress is what has given you heartburn. Stress has caused you to feel irritated, agitated, frustrated, and all pent up inside. Stress is what makes you uptight. It makes you feel like someone's standing on your chest. Even your breathing is constricted. Now everybody take a deep breath. Go ahead. I don't want to incite any panic attacks this morning. We're just talking about stress. And I think we understand it, or at least how it feels to be stressed. But how do we handle it? Maybe that's the question we really want to know the answer to. Because all of us can identify with it. The question is, how do we handle it? Where do we turn? How can we manage the stresses of the holidays and the stresses of life? I think that's what we need to know this morning. Well, there was a study that was done here in the U.S. a number of years ago. It was by two researchers named Perlin and Schooler. They tried to investigate this very question. How do Americans handle stress? And they took their results and they grouped it into three different categories. They said this, some people handle stress, number one, by changing the situation. So if you have a dog and it keeps messing on the carpet, it's causing a lot of stress, then change the situation. Get rid of the dog. Carpet. Get rid of the carpet. I was going to get rid of the dog, but we might as well get rid of the carpet. Whatever you do, you just change the situation, right? Maybe you have kids and they're arguing and whining and they're complaining and it's causing a lot of stress. So you're going to change the situation and get rid of the kids. No, no, no. Tell the kids to go in the basement, right? You're going to try to change the situation. So Some people handle stress by seeking to change the situation. They said, secondly, some people try to handle stress by managing their feelings. So let's say you're getting frustrated with your spouse. So what you do is you take kind of a 20-minute timeout and you leave the room and say, honey, I can't talk right now. I need to regain control. And so you go into the other room and you kind of let your emotions kind of tone down for 20 minutes. You try to manage your feelings. Or maybe you're on I-15. You're headed north. And these people from the on-ramp, these bozos, just cut right in front of you. And it agitates you, and you're all stressed out, and so you give yourself some managing your feelings self-counsel. You say things to yourself like, I will not get mad, I will not honk my horn, I will not salute them. I mean, you tell yourself all of these things, trying to manage your feelings. Well, some people try to handle stress by changing the situation. Some try to handle it by managing their feelings. And these researchers came up with a third category. They said some people try to handle stress by changing the meaning of a stressful situation. So I want you to imagine your mother-in-law is coming to town. And your mother-in-law fulfills all of the traits that are bound up in those jokes. Yeah. And so you say to yourself, I'm not going to get stressed about this. I'm going to change the meaning. My mother-in-law coming is not going to be an opportunity for stress. It's going to be an opportunity for me to grow in patience. It's going to be an opportunity for me to have some character building time. Do you see what I'm trying to do? I'm trying to change the meaning of that situation. And in so doing, try to handle my stress. Well, those are the results of this Perlin and Schooler study. But what I found interesting is that when I look in this passage in Isaiah chapter 7, I actually see all three of those efforts that appear in this text. And I want you to see as we go through this morning, see if you can identify them as we go through. In Isaiah chapter 7, on page 571 in the Pew Bibles, there's an interesting story about a king. He's one of Judah's kings, and his name is Ahaz. Now, I want you to look at the scriptures with me as I read verses 1 and 2 of Isaiah chapter 7. In the days of Ahaz, the son of Jotham, son of Uzziah, king of Judah, Rezin, the king of Syria, and Pekah, the son of Remaliah, the king of Israel, came up to Jerusalem to wage war against it, but could not yet mount an attack against it. Well, when the house of David was told, Syria is in league with Ephraim, the heart of Ahaz and the heart of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake before the wind. So here are these countries. And I think if I explain some of the setup here, you'll understand the stressfulness of this situation. It was a desperate state of affairs for Judah. Two kings actually allied themselves against Ahaz and the kingdom of Judah. You have Rezin from Syria and Pekah from Israel. They unified together to fight against Judah. So it's kind of a two-on-one battle. Maybe I can help you picture this in your mind. Imagine with me if Wyoming and Idaho made an alliance. Now, I don't know how much strength is in Wyoming and Idaho, but just follow along with me here. You've got Wyoming and Idaho, and they make an alliance, and they're going to attack Utah, all right? So it's a two-on-one. And they're able to come down, and they take over Ogden, and they take over Layton and Kaysville, and they keep sweeping on down. They're in Woods Cross, and they're in Bountiful, and they come all the way up to the edge of the capital. They've taken over all of Utah except for our capital. And we've got barricades in the streets, and we've got Wyoming and Idaho, and all of their forces have swept in all the way up to Salt Lake City. And we're trying to hold Salt Lake City. And the state of affairs looks desperate. Well, that's how it was for Judah. You see, Israel and Syria had swept down. They made an alliance. They got all the way up to Jerusalem, the capital city. And here's the king in the capital, and he's saying, what do we do? So you can kind of see it here. There's Syria and Israel. They combine forces. They want to come down and attack Judah. Now, that would be bad enough, but there was one more player that's part of the story. Do you see way up in the north? Do you see that huge empire up there? It's called Assyria. So that would be kind of like, okay, so remember, we've got Idaho and Wyoming. They're attacking Utah. We could surrender to Idaho and Wyoming and join forces with them, and everything would be okay. But it would only be okay for a little while. Because if we join forces with Idaho and Wyoming, then all of Canada is going to come and sweep through and kill us. Now, some of you are thinking, Canada, what do they have? Well, I think I did look this up. This is a terrible analogy, but just go with me on this one. I think Canada has 161 tanks total. And they have 416 aircraft total. So I think Hill Field could probably take out all of Canada. But anyways, just go with the analogy, okay? So we can't, so Judah can't join up with Israel and Syria, because if they do, then all of us, Syria, is going to sweep down and wipe them all out. So they only have really a couple options, and both of them are bad. Do they keep trying to fight Israel and Syria, or do they join them and have Assyria sweep down and wipe them out? So I'm trying to explain this because you got to know that Ahaz is in his capital city. It's the only thing that they've been able to hold, and it's very, very stressful. What does he do? Actually, it's so stressful that in the book of Isaiah, it describes his heart this way. Remember verse 2. The heart of Ahaz and the heart of his people shook as the trees of the forest shake before the wind. He's pretty stressed out. But how does Ahaz respond to the stress? How do we respond to stress? Well, let's keep reading through this. Ahaz responds to the stress by first trying to change the situation. Remember I told you those three tactics would come up? Well, here's the first one. He's going to try to change the situation. And you have to look in some of the other books of the Bible to see how he does this. The historical texts in Chronicles and Kings tell how Ahaz tried to change the situation. So here he is in Jerusalem. He's surrounded. He doesn't know what to do. So he decides, I'm going to try to change things. But Ahaz is an unbelieving king. He does not trust in God. And so the way that he tries to change the situation is bad. Listen as I read 2 Chronicles chapter 28, verse 22. In the time of his distress, so when Ahaz was stressed, in the time of his distress, he became more faithless to the Lord. The same king, Ahaz. He sacrificed to the gods of Damascus and said, because the gods of the king of Syria helped them, I'll sacrifice to them that they may help me also. But they were the ruin of him. And so Ahaz, because that didn't work, Ahaz gathered the vessels of the house of God. So he goes into the temple, gathers the vessels. Now listen to what he does. He cuts in pieces the vessels of the house of God, and he shuts up the doors of the house of the Lord, and he makes himself altars in every corner of Jerusalem. Remember, they're surrounded. He's stressed out. Well, I'll change the situation. I'll change the situation by offering to these other gods. So he goes and seeks other idolatrous gods, and he's going to make offerings to them. But it's the ruin, and those things don't work. You keep reading in 2 Kings chapter 16. Here he is. He's trying to change the situation. He's all stressed out. Listen to the measures he goes to. 2 Kings 16:2. And Ahaz did not do what was right in the eyes of the Lord his God, as the father David had done. But he walked in the ways of the kings of Israel. He even burned his son as an offering, according to the despicable practices of the nations whom the Lord drove out from before the people of Israel. Do you see what he's doing? Here he is, he's all stressed out, doesn't know what to do, the options seem bad. So he says, well, I'll go and close up the temple of the true God. I'll cut up all the pieces there because obviously he doesn't know what's going on. And I'll offer sacrifices to some of these pagan gods. Well, that doesn't work. Well, I know what I'll do. I'll even take my own child and offer him. He's trying to change the situation, but none of these things work. None of his attempts are successful. His sacrifices were vain. His idols were impotent. His resources were spent. And Ahaz couldn't change the situation. You know, I think sometimes we face stressful situations, and what we want to do is change the circumstances. But not all circumstances can be changed, can they? mean, have you faced something stressful recently where it doesn't matter? You just can't change it. There's nothing in your control to be able to change the situation. How about someone in your family who just got diagnosed with a terminal disease? Can you really change that situation and ease the stress? No, that doesn't work. Maybe you're weighed down emotionally because someone you love is making wrong choices in their life. I was talking to a grieving man recently. His son has become a drug addict. He hasn't had contact with him for a long time, and he's just grieving inside. What can he do to change that situation? You see, changing the situation doesn't always ease our stress. What do you do when you get to the holidays and you're away from your family or you've lost a loved one? How are you going to process through Christmas? How can you change that situation? I'll never forget when my grandmother and grandfather died in the same year. And we had spent all of our holidays with them. They were grandma and grandpa countermen. They were my dad's parents. And all of our birthdays and all of our Thanksgivings and all of our Christmases, that's where we went because they were only 4 hours away and the other side of the family was way out in the Midwest. And so it was hard to get to them. So we always spent all of these holidays with my dad's parents. And in 1 year, both of them passed away. And I can remember approaching Christmas time and it was very stressful in my home. I wondered how we were going to do the things that we used to do. Right? I mean, my grandmother used to go out to this market and buy this clam chowder. We had it every Christmas Eve. Well, what was going to happen this Christmas Eve? And I can remember on Christmas morning, my grandma would always stick these fresh oranges and these big apples inside of our stockings, and we loved them as kids. But what was going to happen this year? How was my dad going to process Christmas without his parents this year? What was I going to do when tears just welled up in his eyes? You know, those situations, you just can't change. You can't say, like, well, let's just change the situation and then the stress will go away. No, there's no way you can change it. So that solution just doesn't work for all the stresses of our lives, does it? And it wasn't working for Ahaz here. No matter what he tried, he could not change his situation. But as we keep reading this text, we realize that not all hope is lost. Maybe he couldn't change the situation, but all hope is not gone. You see, God was there. He's not alone stuck there in Jerusalem with no help. Actually, God knows exactly what's going on. God was aware of the situation in Judah, and so he sends his prophet to the scene. Take a look at Isaiah chapter 7, verse number 3. The Lord said to Isaiah, "Go out to meet Ahaz, you and Shear-Jashub, your son, at the end of the conduit of the upper pool on the highway of the washer's field, and say to him, 'Be careful to be quiet. Do not fear. Do not let your heart be faint because of these two smoldering stumps of firebrand.'" He's saying here, God sends Isaiah out to meet the king. And Isaiah the prophet goes up to him and he says, "Listen, king, you need to calm down. You need to take a deep breath. Don't be stressed about this situation." That's what he's telling him. He's telling the king to calm down. Now, have you ever had someone try to tell you to calm down when you're stressed out? Anyone here? Husbands, you ever try that with your wives? How does that work? Right. I mean, when you're stressed out and someone looks at you and says, "Calm down, be quiet, take a deep breath." When someone does that, usually it evokes the opposite response, doesn't it? So here you are, this person's telling you to calm down. And you're like, "Well, you don't know what I'm going through. It's not your situation. You don't understand. How can I be quiet right now?" You get all worked up when someone tries you to calm you down. And I think that's probably what happened with Ahaz. Imagine the prophet coming to Ahaz and saying, "Do not fear." He looks out, he says, "Don't fear. Look at the two nations that are piled up against us. Calm down. Keep your heart calm. Keep my heart calm. They're about to tear Jerusalem stone by stone. How can I keep my heart calm?" Here he's trying to tell him to manage his emotions, to control his feelings. But we can't always do that, can we? I mean, when we're feeling the stress of life, are you 100% successful at managing your emotions? Are you always capable of keeping your feelings under control? I don't think any of us probably are. I think sometimes you have people in your life maybe that irritate you and you say, I'm not going to get irritated. I'm not going to get irritated. I'm not going to get irritated. Next thing you know, what are you? You're irritated. You think, I'm not going to get upset. I'm not going to get upset. I'm not going to get upset. And next thing you know, you're upset. I mean, you can try to manage your feelings. You can try to control your emotions, but that doesn't always work. So here's Isaiah. He's with the king and he says, do not fear. Do not let your heart be faint. But you can almost imagine King Ahaz saying, it's not going to work. I can't manage my feelings. I can't manage my emotions. But God wasn't done talking. You see, God didn't want to just tell Ahaz to manage his emotions. Notice with me verses 7, 8, and 9. Isaiah 7, verse 7. Thus says the Lord God, it shall not stand, and it shall not come to pass. For the head of Syria is Damascus, and the head of Damascus is Rezin, and within 65 years, Ephraim will be shattered from being a people. And the head of Ephraim is Samaria, and the head of Samaria is the son of Remaliah. If you are not firm in faith, you will not be firm at all. Here's what Isaiah says. He says, listen, God has decided that within 65 years, Israel, remember to the north, Israel was trying to attack. He says, Israel is going to no longer be a nation within 65 years. And that did happen, actually, in 722 BC. Assyria comes down and just completely wipes out the northern kingdom of Israel. And you can read your world history books. They get exiled and dispersed abroad. So it happens. So that does come to pass. He says, within 65 years, they're not going to be here. He says, what you need to do is be established in your faith. He says, be firm in your faith. If you're not firm in your faith, you will not be firm at all. Literally, he's saying this, you need to live by faith or you will not live at all, King Ahaz. What God is trying to get him to do here is not change the situation, not manage your feelings. What God is trying to get Ahaz to do here is change his perspective on the situation by looking through a new lens called the lens of faith. Listen, King Ahaz, you need to have faith. You need to be established in your faith. Otherwise, you're not going to be established at all. God wanted Ahaz to look at his situation in a new light. He wanted him to look through the lens of faith and change his perspective. It's as though God is saying, hey, Ahaz, remember me? I'm the sovereign Lord. I'm the king over all, and I'm going to take care of this. Look to me with faith. It's as though God is trying to draw his attention that way. In the midst of life's stresses, God calls us to live by faith. So I wonder, what's the stress right now in your life? What's the stress right now in your family's life? What is it that you're going through? Have you been able to change the situation? Have you been able to manage your feelings? God says, change your perspective by looking to me with faith. That's what he wanted Ahaz to do. Ahaz, respond to me with faith. Do you think Ahaz does it? Well, keep reading. Look at verse number 10. When we get here, what you're going to find is that Ahaz does not want God to intrude in his affairs. Ahaz does not want God to interrupt his plans. It's kind of foolish, but notice what Ahaz says in verse number 10. Again, the Lord spake to Ahaz, ask a sign of the Lord your God. Let it be as deep as Sheol or as high as heaven. But Ahaz said, I will not ask. I will not put the Lord to a test. Well, what's going on here? Well, it's as though God is holding out a blank check. He says, Ahaz, you ask for whatever you want, and I will prove to you. I'll give you a sign, any sign you want. Remember, a blank check. Fill it out however you'd like, and I will prove to you that I am able to do what I promised. I am able to handle this stressful situation. And wouldn't that be amazing? You're all stressed out about something in your life. You don't know how to change it, and God comes to you and says, listen, I'm going to take care of this. And to prove it to you, I'm going to let you pick any sign you want, and I'll prove it to you through a sign that I can take care of your stressful situation. That's what God does to Ahaz. And Ahaz says, no thanks. I don't want to put the Lord to a test. He uses these religious words, but really they come from a rebellious heart. He just doesn't want God to intrude in his situation. He knows that if he lets God in, then God is going to take control. He knows that if he lets God in that situation, then God's strategy is going to be the one that he has to follow. He knows that if he lets God in, then God is going to be the one to receive glory. And so he says, no, no thanks. And he's willfully unbelieving to God. Now, Isaiah, I kind of like this because you get a little vim and vigor out of some of these prophets. They're not politically correct. They just give it to you. And that's what you have here with Isaiah. He is upset. It's like he's vehement because Ahaz has just insulted the true and living God. God offers him a sign and he says, no thanks, God. I don't want one. So here's how Isaiah responds. Notice verse number 13. Then he, meaning Isaiah, said, hear then, O house of David, is it too little for you to weary men that you weary my God also? Therefore the Lord himself will give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son and shall call his name Emmanuel. Isaiah is piping hot at this point. He says, fine, you don't want God to be part of the solution? Fine, you don't want God to enter into the trouble and resolve the stress of your life? Fine, you don't want to ask for a sign? Too bad, he's going to give you a sign anyways. That's what he says. And here's the sign. The sign is going to be a miraculous sign. It's going to be a sign that God can bring peace to the stressful situations of life. The sign is Emmanuel, meaning God with us. That's the sign. A virgin will conceive and bear a son, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Isaiah describes this Emmanuel. If you go two chapters forward in the book of Isaiah, in Isaiah 9, he says, unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. The government will be upon his shoulders. Not yours, Ahaz. The government will be upon his shoulders. His name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father. What's the last one? Prince of Peace. You know, to the stressful situations of life, God gives a sign. It's Emmanuel, the Prince of Peace. Well, Ahaz faced this situation, a distressful situation. He couldn't change it by his own power. It was so stressful that he felt like he couldn't manage his own emotions. So God offered him an opportunity to change his perspective by faith, but he wouldn't embrace it. Now, you may think that this is the end of the story. So you have Ahaz, he's faithless. It begins the downward spiral of Judah. Basically, in 586 BC, Babylon will come and will exile the people of Judah. You think then there's these little two words that scroll up on the screen, the end. Dun, dun, dun. But that's not what happens. You see, here in Isaiah chapter 7, there's a promise that's made. A virgin will conceive and bear a son and call his name Emmanuel. So even though Ahaz rejected it, God was still going to fulfill his promise. You see, this promise would be repeated to another man. Another man about 700 years later who found himself in a stressful situation. Do you know that man's name? Joseph. Now, I said he was in a stressful situation. Do you know Joseph's stressful situation? Turn with me to Matthew chapter 1. So here's a promise. Ahaz rejects it, but God doesn't let it drop. God will fulfill this promise, and he's going to fulfill it to another man who's in a stressful situation named Joseph. If you're using a Pew Bible, it's page 807, and we're in Matthew chapter 1. I'll read there in just a moment, but let me see if I can explain the nature of Joseph's stress. Now, back in those times, in that culture, men would be engaged to be married, normally around 18 years old. They would be established in whatever trade they were in. See, back then, you didn't go to college and pick your major. Be like, I want to be a biochemist. I want to be a physicist. I want to be a... No, you didn't do that. Basically, whatever your father was, that's what you were. And so by the time you were 18, you probably learned the trade. You could be financially established. And then your parents would arrange a marriage. How would you like that? We have some people here from cultures like that, where the parents arrange the marriage. Well, that's what happened in this culture. So here's Joseph. He's probably about 18 years old. He's a carpenter. He's learned woodworking. That's his trade. And he's come of age, and he's financially settled. And so his parents talk to another set of parents. And they say, well, let's have our children be married. And the name of the girl, probably between 13 and 15 years old. That's when they got married back then. The name of the girl was Mary. And so the two have a contract that's drawn up. Now, back then it was called betrothal. It's a little different than engagement. We have a couple here that just got engaged recently. You know, then you get down on one knee and you say, will you marry me? And you give them a ring and there's a pledge. But it was a little more entailing when they did betrothal, because you'd have to sign a contract of marriage. You would have to pay a bride's price. So you had to pay money. There's a contract that's signed. It was a very, very formal thing. It was such a formal contract of marriage that actually, if let's say the man died before the marriage was consummated, if the man died, that girl would be called a widow because they had been betrothed. Or if there was a reason that they had to separate, you would have to go through a divorce. So betrothal was the contract of marriage before the consummation, the physical consummation of marriage. But it was a binding contract. And so here's this guy, probably 18 years old, named Joseph. He's a woodworker. He's got his own little shop. Maybe he makes chairs and tables and things like that. And his parents line him up with a girl named Mary. And they're betrothed. The contract is signed. The bride price is paid. They're contracted to be married. And Mary says, oh, Joseph. One day she comes to him, Joseph, my cousin Elizabeth is pregnant, and I'm going to go visit her. You can read about this in Luke chapter 1. So Mary goes away for 3 months. She's with her cousin Elizabeth. Elizabeth gives birth to a son named John, John the Baptist, right? After 3 months of visiting her cousin, she comes back. But she comes back different. You see, while she was gone, an angel appeared to her. It said, Mary, you're going to have a child. You will conceive in your womb and bear a son. The Holy Spirit will come upon you, and the power of the Most High will overshadow you. Therefore, the child to be born will be called Holy, the Son of God. Mary says, but I have not known a man. He said, this will be a miraculous thing of the Holy Spirit. A virgin would conceive. So this all happens while she's visiting her cousin. 3 months later, she comes back and has some news to tell Joseph. Joseph, it's a miracle. There was an angel. He appeared to me. He said, I'm going to have the Son of God. I am pregnant. Would you believe it? Joseph is a good man. He doesn't want to shame Mary. He's a good man. But Joseph is a stretched and stressed man. Because here, the woman that he was betrothed to is pregnant with some fandangled explanation of a miracle, of nothing happened, you know what I mean? And so he decides that he's going to quietly divorce her. That's what it says in verse number 19. He's at his wit's end, a stressful situation. So he resolved to divorce her quietly. But as he considered these things, verse number 20, behold, an angel of the Lord appeared to him in a dream, saying, Joseph, son of David, do not fear to take Mary as your wife, for that which is conceived in her is from the Holy Spirit. She will bear a son, and you will call his name Jesus, for he will save his people from their sins. All this took place to fulfill what the Lord had spoken by the prophet. What prophet? Isaiah. Behold, verse 23, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son, and they shall call his name, say it with me, Emmanuel. Here, in a time of stress, Joseph couldn't control his feelings. He couldn't change the situation. But God wanted him to change his perspective by looking to him through the lens of faith. This child is the Son of God, Joseph. This child is the Savior of the world, and his birth is miraculous. This is Emmanuel, as the prophet foretold. Now, where Ahaz said no to God, Joseph says yes. Do you realize that one of the great celebrations of Christmas is the fact that we can be delivered from the stress and the strain and the sin that binds our life? We can be delivered from it because a child is born. And it's not just any child. It's Emmanuel, God with us. And so we're called to look to him in faith. We can't always change our situation. And we can't always control our feelings and emotions. But we can change our perspective in times of stress and look to him in faith. Emmanuel makes it possible for us to change our perspective. Do you know the promise of God's presence? That's what Emmanuel means. Emmanuel means God with you. The promise of God's presence can change the meaning of every stressful situation in your life. Think about that for a second. Can you add God's presence to the stress of your life and expect it to stay the same? No. When you add God to the equation of life, it's no longer life plus holidays equals stress. It's life plus Emmanuel equals a whole new perspective on life. The meaning of life and its circumstances can change for the better because God is with you, Emmanuel. No longer is the pain of a lost loved one something you have to bear on your own. Why? Because of Emmanuel. God is with you. No longer is the stress of a work situation something you have to endure by yourself. Why? Because of Emmanuel. God is with you. No longer do you need to struggle under the weight of strained finances, tough job assignments, difficult people, strained relationships, or spiritual battles alone. Why? Because God is with you. Emmanuel, whatever the source of your stress this season or in the months to come, remember that God is with you. Emmanuel. Now, some of you may be wondering, does this really work? I mean, you're telling me, okay, I need to look through the lens of faith, and because Emmanuel, God with us, is here, then these things of stress will change. Does it really work? I want to close with just two last case studies. One is a man named David. Can you remember David in the Bible? Did he ever have any stress in his life? Yeah. He knew the stress of losing a child. David knew the stress of seeing a son rebel. David knew the stress of being betrayed by a close friend. He knew the stress of being the object of someone's unjust cruelty. David was a man who knew stress. And yet, he understood Emmanuel. Listen to what he says in Psalm 23, verse 4. Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for thou art with me. Do you know that's what Emmanuel means? God with us. God with us changes everything. You can even walk through valleys where death shadows loom, and you can make it because of Emmanuel. David understood that. How about one of the disciples of Jesus named Matthew? I think he went through some stress, but he understood Emmanuel. He went through the stress of losing a close friend to a brutal murder. He went through the stress of heavy responsibility and life change. Matthew was a man who knew stress. And yet he took comfort in some of Jesus' final words. Matthew 28:20. "And lo, I am with you always." That's Emmanuel. "And lo, I am with you always, even unto the end of the world." As you pass through the stressful situations of this season, or those in the months to come, make the promise of Emmanuel personal. Say in your heart, "God is with me," and let His presence make all the difference in the world.